This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, why does the United States choose its presidents every 4 years through a process called the Electoral College rather than by the national popular vote? Is the Electoral College a vestige of a bygone era, or is it still a fair process by which to elect the President of the United States? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The Electoral College consists of 538 electors. A majority of 270 electoral votes is required to elect the President. A state's entitled allotment of electors equals the number of members in its congressional delegation, so one for each member in the House of Representatives, plus two for senators. And each state, regardless of its size or population, has two senators. In this winner-take-all system, whichever candidate wins the popular vote in a certain state wins all of that state's Electoral College votes, and whoever garners the most Electoral College votes wins the presidency. However, many Senate Democrats, several 2020 presidential hopefuls, and a good chunk of Americans want to abolish the Electoral College and allow presidential candidates to be elected by the national popular vote. The debate gained traction in the year 2000 after Democrat Al Gore lost the presidential election to Republican George W. Bush, despite winning the popular vote. More recently, Republican Donald Trump prevailed in the Electoral College despite losing the popular vote to Democrat Hillary Clinton by about 3 million votes. So the last two Republicans to win the presidency received fewer votes than their Democratic opponents. Before he won the presidency, Mr. Trump called the Electoral College, quote, a disaster for our democracy, unquote. But a few days after his victory, when he won the Electoral College and lost the popular vote, he called it, quote, genius, unquote. Opponents of the Electoral College say it is undemocratic because it can elect someone who loses the nationwide popular vote and because it encourages candidates to focus only on a few key swing states. Supporters of the system say that without it, the candidates might ignore rural states and give too much attention to more populous urban centers. Well, joining us to discuss the merits and drawbacks of the Electoral College are two distinguished political analysts. John Fortier is the director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. That's a think tank here in Washington. He's the author and editor of After the People Vote, A Guide to the Electoral College. And of course, John is a frequent guest at these VOA microphones. And Jim Thurber, he's a distinguished professor of government and the founder and former director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, John Fortier, let me begin with you. You're the author of After the People Vote, A Guide to the Electoral College. When and why did the U.S. Founding Fathers establish the Electoral College?
Well, we established it at the beginning. It has changed slightly since then, but it served several functions. One, it was a late development in our Constitutional Convention. The founders had to figure out how to form Congress and other institutions first, and a lot of that had to do with the balancing of the interests of the smaller states and the more populous states. Our Senate represents states, our House of Representatives represents population. But a couple of key points that they wanted to get. One was they decided they did not want the legislature to elect the president. They wanted an independent method of electing that person. You see in many European countries parliamentary systems where a member of the parliament actually becomes the prime minister, essentially as the head of the executive. They didn't want that. They wanted independence. Secondly, they were also worried that the states themselves, which were former colonies, were likely to look just to local people, people in their own state, and they wanted to create national figures. And at least the original design of the Electoral College was for one candidate to come forward which people could vote for in their state, and then the other one, they might cast a vote that really was more of a national figure, a George Washington, but they were looking for those sorts of people. So those were some of the reasons at the time, which may not be as applicable today, but those were the key reasons that the Electoral College was developed at the start.
So, Jim Thurber, this is a compromise between election of the president by a vote in Congress and election of the president by a popular vote of qualified citizens, the Electoral College. What are your thoughts?
Yes, it's a compromise, just like the Constitution in many other areas are a compromise. And this is one that took a long time to come together. to protect the states, federalism, but also to make sure that Congress had a limited role in selecting the president, which helps our separation of powers. Many nations around the world elect a president in a popular way, and then they select the prime minister through their legislatures, and that's the person with the power. In most cases, that is the case in a parliamentary system. We do not have that. The way we select a president and a vice president protects that separation of powers and also protects the states, but it also has a bias towards small states, some people think. Some people think it's not democratic. Most of the proposals to change this are for direct popular election, and others from the small states certainly don't agree with that, and since going through a constitutional amendment includes getting two-thirds of the states to support this, it's unlikely that states will support that kind of reform.
We'll get into the pros and cons shortly, but let me get back to John Fortier. A question that probably many around the world and here in the United States are asking, is the Electoral College still relevant? Why not turn to the popular vote, since we're seeing this discrepancy between popular vote and Electoral College votes? We're seeing recently, as I said in the introduction, presidents winning the Electoral College, but losing by large numbers, in the case of Mr. Trump, the popular vote. So that is causing people to question the relevancy of the Electoral College here in the United States.
Well, I think the reasons for keeping the Electoral College today are different than the reasons that we put it in place in the first place. I'm not sure that we would have the Electoral College if we had a new constitutional convention, but there are a couple of things that I would point to. One is that the alternatives have some problems as well. National popular vote, depending on how one structures it, might cause fracturing of candidates and parties and multiple candidates. There are ways to deal with that, but the Electoral College has a way of picking a winner, and usually picking a winner between two major candidates. And then the other one that Jim referred to is that the states are still important entities in America. We are not simply a national country without subsidiary bodies. And we have great varieties of the way we vote in various states. Now, some people don't like that. Some people think we should be more uniform. But we vote with different hours in different states. We vote with early voting in places. Some places we allow felons to vote or not. There are a lot of differences between the states. And so going to a national popular vote sounds simple, but it might mean wiping out some of those differences, and differences that many of the states want as well. And then I guess the last thing is, well, I certainly think there is some possibility for, as we've seen, the result going the other way. It is the case that the states are real political entities. And there's something, I think, healthy of presidential candidates going to states that are communities that elect their own representatives, or elect governors and state legislatures, and having to appeal to those political cultures. It's not all in one region. It's not all urban versus rural. But it does force the candidates to go to places that have real political systems that are subnational.
So back to you, Jim. Earlier you were talking about some of the arguments against the electoral system, but what about arguments for maintaining the system in addition to what John said?
Let's summarize all of this by saying that there are some people who want to end it. There's some people who want to amend it, change it at the state level, and there's some people who want to leave it alone. I think there's probably a majority of those in public office that would leave it alone. And so I think it's unrealistic to have a direct popular election. There's not a lot of support for it. Certainly among the general public, they think that's a fair thing to do, but it would disenfranchise some of the small states, rural states, and as you know, in America, we have sorting of our voters between urban and rural, and that makes a difference when these proposals go forward. I think one proposal that has some traction is not only the national popular vote, which looks like it's gaining more traction with support from Colorado and New Mexico. We can go back and discuss this in more detail later. But also, states have the capacity to select electors in those states in a variety of ways, like in Nebraska and Maine. They could go to proportional representation, which means that if someone wins in a particular congressional district, they get those votes. Now, if you go back to 2000, we've only had three elections where the popular vote was less than the majority in the Electoral College. And as you know, and that was 1888 and 2000 and 2016. Now, in 2000, if we calculated proportional representation by the district level, Gore would have lost. A lot of people don't realize that. And it was really a tied election. It came down to one state, Florida. And in the end, the Supreme Court made a decision as to who would be the president of the United States. Now, if we had had proportional representation throughout the United States, he would clearly have been the president of the United States. Most people don't realize that, but Bush would have been.
Well, we'll have more in a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. Our guests are John Fortier. He's the director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center and author of After the People Vote, A Guide to the Electoral College. And Jim Thurber. He's distinguished professor of government and the founder and former director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. And we're discussing the pros and cons of the Electoral College, the system that the United States uses to elect its president. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout-out to a loyal listener, Jude Dengana Sunday from Bauchi, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion about the Electoral College. So, John Fortier, we've been talking about arguments for keeping the system, but let's look at the arguments against the Electoral College as we see so many, particularly Democratic hopefuls in this election season, railing against it, saying it's unfair, saying that it causes people to go to what we call the swing states, concentrate much of their time because California will probably be blue, i.e. Democratic, other red states, and they're deprived of these candidates. So what other arguments do we know that militate for the national popular vote?
Well, there are a couple of arguments against the Electoral College. And one is that there's a sort of inequality of votes in the states, that if you're a voter in Wyoming, you actually have slightly more representation in the Electoral College than you do in California. That's because the part of the calculation for electors, including the Senate, Wyoming gets as many senators as does California. And so it's partly represented in the Electoral College as well. The other big point, and Jim alluded to this, is we don't have to do this, but most of the states, 48 of them, have winner-take-all. So if you win the vote in a state by even a small number of votes, you get all of the electors. You're going to get all of California's 55 if you win this state by just a few votes. And that is what really did drive the difference between the popular vote in 2016, with Donald Trump losing the popular vote but winning the Electoral College. In part because states like California really, Hillary Clinton ran up the score, won it by several million votes, more than the national margin. And if you do very, very well in some states and then the other person wins some states very closely, that can cause the difference. And so I think the big arguments against it are really for a sort of an equality of the vote and ultimately probably for more uniform ways of voting across all the states. I think Jim was right about popular opinion. At least the public has always been, as long as we've been polling, a little skeptical of the Electoral College, wanting more of a national popular vote. It changes a bit after an election like the one we've had. Republicans are now more for the Electoral College and Democrats even more against. But generally, majorities of 60% or so have been for the national popular vote. But it hasn't often been such a strong view that it's pushed to be able to amend the Constitution, which is the traditional way of changing it. There is also this alternative method that Jim referred to of the National Popular Vote Initiative, which is a more indirect way of changing it, which is a little easier, but still quite difficult.
I do want to get into those alternatives in a moment, but back to you, Jim Thurber, regarding the arguments against maintaining this Electoral College. What would you add or subtract to what John said, particularly the focus on the swing states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Florida, where the candidates go there and ignore any solidly red or blue states?
We basically have a presidential election that occurs in about 10 so-called battleground states, except in California and New York, they use those states to bring in a lot of money to pay for the battles in those other states. And so if you had a different form of selecting the president, they would maybe focus on issues that were more widely dispersed throughout the United States rather than those that seemed to appeal to those battleground states. That occurred this time with Hillary Clinton and President Trump. Trump did appeal to people in the upper tier Midwest, which became a key aspect of that election, in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And there, people are hurting. He appealed to them, a populist appeal. She did not. She won in the wrong places, some people say. She ran up the score in the wrong places, in the blue areas that are doing very well in America, that are within 50 miles of the ocean in California, Oregon, Washington, Northeast, And she failed to appeal to those people where Trump won. If you had a different approach, the candidates would be forced to go to many more states. We've had candidates that promised to go to every state, which was a mistake strategically. But it would be good if they focused a little bit more on rural issues as well as urban issues and focused on areas outside of those battleground states. But remember, it was mentioned before by John that we've had proposed constitutional amendments. None of them have been approved by two-thirds members of both houses since we last amended the Constitution on this issue. It doesn't seem to be even able to get over that barrier, let alone getting two-thirds of the states to approve it within 7 years.
Here's a quick question, John Fortier. It seems that Republicans are generally opposed to abolishing the Electoral College and Democrats more in favor of eliminating it. How do you explain that?
Yeah, I think there used to be some arguments, older arguments, that people from small states were more in favor of the Electoral College and large against, because there's a slight bias for the small states. But I don't think that's true anymore. I think it is very much a partisan breakdown. Even before the Trump or even Bush elections, I think there's broadly some sense on the Democratic side of more concern about equality of the vote, and some on the Republican side about preserving tradition and keeping with what works. So I think that's true. It has changed, though, once we have elections that clarify the issues. So after the 2000 election, Republicans moved to be more for the Electoral College and Democrats even more against. That eventually kind of went back to normal, 60% or so being against it. And after this election, we see again the same pattern. So today, Republicans are very much more defenders of this. And the Democrats and the Democratic presidential candidates are very, very, they're outspoken. They feel it more strongly. So the Electoral College is actually slightly more popular today than it was. It's still unpopular by public opinion, but that's probably because the movement of most Republicans to saying, hey, why are we talking about changing this now just after we won an election in that way?
Interesting. You know, the Republicans often accuse the Democrats of being partisan in this regard, saying that they want to abolish it, but they are also to some extent partisan if they're benefiting from the system. How do you explain the partisan breakdown, Jim Thurber?
Well, I think there is a partisan breakdown, and it's both parties are focused on this for partisan reasons. Democrats and Republicans, America is highly divided, even though we have institutions that are trying to bring people together in the middle. It's very hard. Partisan politics has intervened in this. Now, if Texas becomes Democratic, it's becoming sort of purple, meaning it's leaning towards the Democrats, and you have Texas, and you have New York, and you have California, and you have Illinois, those states, all Democratic, as well as Oregon and Washington and some others, maybe there will be a change of attitude by the Republicans and they'll want another approach. Again, I think that maybe you could find common ground in the area of proportional representation within the states, but it doesn't seem to have any movement towards that in any of the states at this point.
So let's take a look at whether or not it's time to reform. John Fortier, given two of the last five presidential elections gave the presidency to someone who received fewer votes than the opponent, some analysts say that it's natural that let's take a look at this, forget the partisan part of it. So earlier, Jim Thurber brought up this idea of a national popular vote interstate compact. If a state agrees to it, it guarantees that that state's electoral votes would go to the winner of the national popular vote. But that's only if enough states sign on. So that's problematic because only 13 states and the District of Columbia have signed on, which makes for 184 electoral votes, but we would need 270. So talk about various possibilities for modifying the system and, of course, the obstacles.
Well, I think it's useful to step back and just remind ourselves of how the Electoral College works. And that is, essentially, we have 50, or with the District of Columbia, 51 separate elections across the country. Now, those elections, it looks like when you go to the polling place that you're voting for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, but really you are voting for these people called electors. And those people will come together later in December and cast the final votes that make a president. In some states, you'll actually see the names of these electors. You've never heard of them underneath the candidates. Some states, you won't even see them. But you really are voting for those people. But what is different about our system is that we don't have to give the winner take all. And most of the states do, 48 of the states plus D.C. If you win the state, you get all of the electors being loyal to that candidate. All of Donald Trump's electors will be loyal to him from Pennsylvania if he wins by even one vote. And so there are alternatives to what states can do. And mostly they don't do it. Maine and Nebraska, Jim Thurber mentioned, they elect through this district system where if you win a congressional district, you get one elector, and you win the other one, you get another, and you get two statewide. Back in the early days of the country, we sometimes had the state legislatures directly appointing them. We didn't even have popular elections in states. So there are options. And that is the idea of these new reformers and the national popular vote. What they're saying is state legislatures can say, hey, instead of having the electors from the state vote for the state's winner, Pennsylvania, Donald Trump won, we're going to say those electors need to be loyal to the winner of the national popular vote. We'll go out and calculate the national popular vote. Even if our state didn't vote the way the nation did, we're going to say our electors have to vote that way. And what that means is if you get enough states, adding up to 270 electoral votes, passing laws like this, then in theory, all of their electors will vote for the national popular vote winner. And the reason for this really is because it's hard to make this change, but it's much easier than a constitutional amendment, which would require two-thirds of the House and the Senate, as well as three-quarters of the states. And so by persuading states that add up to a majority of the Electoral College to take this system, you will move effectively to a kind of back way of getting the national popular vote. I will say the states that have done it so far are Democratic states, are blue states. To get to 270, you're going to need some purple and maybe a red state or two, and those will be harder to get. But many of the blue states have moved to wanting to implement this system. If enough states come in, then it all takes force.
So we're moving toward that system, this national popular vote, Jim Thurber, but you need more states to be able to enact it, more states that would make up the 270 electoral votes. We know that the constitutional amendment is probably a non-starter. It's very difficult, as you both articulated. How do you see this particular modification, the national popular vote, going forward?
Well, I think the national popular vote, as mentioned by John, is hitting a red wall, maybe a purple wall in some cases, a red wall, and you do need some support from Republicans. I don't see that coming. But also, there are many who feel this is an end run around our Constitution, that it would circumvent the amending process, which is very hard on purpose. And so they are traditionalists. They don't like this. But also, some minorities say that it would dilute minority voting rights under the Voting Rights Act, which is a serious problem. The NPV supporters assert that it would not undermine that. But the key problem is that they need more than just blue states. If you look at the states that have signed up so far, almost all of them except Colorado, I guess, is purple. They're all pretty blue. And I would not bet that it would pass without some dramatic change in attitudes by the Republicans.
Well, back to you, John Fortier, as we close. It's not on the top of anyone's agenda, abolishing the Electoral College, but it has become an issue, particularly among Democratic candidates. They're talking about how unfair it is. Do you anticipate that, if not in the near term, but perhaps in the long run, there will be some changes and that some Republican states either will flip to Democratic or somehow there will be a critical mass that will press for a change?
Well, it's hard to see too far in the future, and things do change. In 2000, we thought that actually if the Electoral College were to go one way and the popular vote were to go the other, it might have been Al Gore winning the Electoral College and George Bush winning the popular vote. Sometimes hard to see. There are some trends that might point to Donald Trump's current coalition being able to win with even fewer votes in the future, but it's a little hard to see that crystal ball, and I think we're unlikely to see the popular vote go one way and the Electoral College go the other way. It does require a bigger consensus, whether it's Republicans or a very big Democratic majority in a number of states, probably not even in the Congress. So it's difficult to do. So I still think it's a hard road to hoe as we go ahead.
The last word to you, Jim Thurber.
Sure. I hate to say this, but I think that it's an easy issue for Democratic candidates in the sense that they can advocate for it. It's probably not going to happen. It's popular with the base of the party. It's sort of a wedge issue that motivates the base of the party, but it's unlikely we'll get a change in policy.
On that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, John Fortier, director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center and an expert on the Electoral College, and Jim Thurber, distinguished professor of government and the founder and former director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. Gentlemen, thanks so much for shedding light on this very important issue.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rob McLean. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.